Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, friends, we're going to begin the discussion part of this segment in 2 minutes, and I have good news. It's not perfect news, but your emails from the first session have arrived. And I'm so glad you really did send them. I love you. We will make a PDF and send it to each person's email address so that you do have that material. It will not be lost or forgotten. Please do email your responses to Saj. We're not going to project them now. We're going to go right into the discussion in a minute. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to begin the discussion now. We have the mics and
who wants my microphone?
Lynn and Susan are ready to take your questions, comments. Responses.
Hi there, Susan. It's me. It's Leslie Cormack from the University of Alberta. So we haven't actually sent something yet because it was such a diverse conversation that I'm not sure we know what our answer is. But we had a big conversation about this question of what admissions would be like if we were attentive to diversity and career goals. And we felt that before we could answer that question, we needed to think about to what end diversity, like what did we want, what was important. And I'm not sure we completely answered that. But we did say that we really needed that what would look different is if students said, I want to do a PhD because I have a plan to work for an NGO, and that should not put them down the list, but that might actually show that they knew what they were doing and that should be a reason to admit them. Likewise, we talked about the fact that we needed to think about not just having the kind of mini-me going through the same discipline all the way through as the only path to admission into the PhD program.
So one of the things that we talked about, Matthew Gaster, University of Waterloo, PhD student. One of the things we talked about at our table, right here.
Hi.
One of the things that we talked about was the second question, referring to people in PhD programs as junior researchers. And we had a rather nuanced and complicated discussion that didn't entirely go anywhere, but one thing that we were thinking about and talking about was some of the economics of the process and some of the current difficulties where students are simultaneously students and junior researchers and employees, and the difficulties that that currently raises for how students are treated by the university, and likewise how by changing the framework, and we weren't entirely convinced if junior researcher was the right term, since we've been talking about, as you mentioned, junior researcher to become not a researcher because there's no jobs as researchers, but that it would also highlight some of the disparities that exist when senior researchers are making a lot of money and junior researchers are making very little and having to pay tuition still out of their very little. And also the fact that PhD people in PhD programs still kind of are students in some ways. They're not purely researchers. They're not purely employees. So we basically just highlighted all the difficulties with trying to reterm it, but it was something that we discussed a lot about.
Sorry, could I just add something about the admissions comment that was made there? If you start thinking about admissions, there's very, very little research. It looks like people don't often examine their admissions processes, and I think that's a big error. There was an interesting piece of research that was done about 4 or 5 years ago, where a department decided to change their admissions process. They said, right now it's not a level playing field. Everybody's sending in their GPA or whatever, so that's previous learning that's not related to the future learning, and they're sending in their research statement or research proposal, but how do we compare those? So they decided they wanted one single way of comparing students. And so what they did was each year they send out to students or people who are applying an article, and they're asked to do a critique that's a certain number of words, and so they have a level playing field for comparing the ways in which people respond. And in what they did was they chose articles, they always choose articles, this is a social sciences department, about the challenges of doing a PhD. And so it gets people thinking about the fact that it's not a straightforward thing. Anyway, I just thought you might be interested in that. As regards the junior researcher, yes, I think we're fraught. I mean, the whole issue of discourse is fraught. But I do think it's very interesting how in Europe, especially in the Scandinavian countries, people are seen as staff when they do their PhDs. So I'm not saying it resolves the issues, but it does treat people somewhat differently, because a label says a lot.
And I would add that it also brings to light some of the things that you were recognizing of pay differentials, of how people are treated. And if we just shift the name, but we understand the responsibilities are the same, it shouldn't make that much of a difference of how we would treat people. I think is an important thing for us to consider.
So we had two comments about two different questions. On the admissions one, we actually wanted to back up a little bit and think in terms of the kinds of programs that we're offering to students who might be interested in a range of career options. And so one of the things that we were talking a lot about was really beefing up our master's offerings. A lot of the job titles that you listed there we thought would be perfect for someone doing a master's in public humanities. That a PhD is designed to do something slightly different, but that a master's might be one of the things that Canadian universities really have going for us is a really healthy terminal MA. And so we were thinking about that as something we could be offering that gives students more choice in how to pursue their various goals. On the subject of supervision, just like this table, we took a step back and said supervision is really a symptom. Our concern with supervision is really a symptom of the diverse and complicated and, head-butting kind of roles that students in programs do experience, that they are members of unions, they are also apprentices, they are pre-professionals, they are emerging adults, they are students, they are all of those things. And it seemed to us the most productive thing was not to go after the supervisor and the supervisor's role as the sort of place where all of this has to happen. Many of us reported having quite indifferent and basically absent supervisors, but that making the entire program more conscious of the conflict between those kinds of roles that people in the program experience would be a more productive way to focus our energy.
Let me ask a question. I was very interested in the idea of opening up the supervision so that it's a collective undertaking where the supervisor is a representative of a larger collectivity. And connected to that is separating supervision support from supervision as judgment. And for me was a new thought. I haven't thought about that. Could you guys talk a little bit more about that idea of opening supervision and the connected idea of separating support from judgment?
Okay. So I'll take up the second one first. And I think it's a very, I had not experienced it until I went to the UK, and I found that the supervisor is not involved in any of the benchmark assessments, for instance, comps or qualifying papers or the thesis proposal or even the final defense. And it suddenly gave me a new way of understanding how that supports not only the student, but the supervisor. So the student isn't assured they're going to get outside feedback at these points in time that are not connected to the supervisor or the co-supervisor or the committee. And it means that the department is more invested in the development of students, because you look within the department pretty much for people who are outside of the committee, but they get to know what the students are doing. So it gives that feedback to the student. It also helps the supervisor, because the supervisor, I think we've all probably had the experience where you and the person you're working with, you're talking at cross purposes and somehow things aren't quite working out. And suddenly to have external people saying the same kinds of things can be very productive. It's like getting reviews on an article, you know, from these outside people. So I think it has loads of potential, because it means that then your job as a supervisor is just helping the student move forward, and you know that's disconnected from the assessment. As regards collective supervision, there's some research, and this is a broader question than collective supervision, or broader response. There's some research that suggests that the more students are involved in choosing the supervisor, and the later that they choose the supervisor, the more satisfied they are and the more quickly they moved forward. Because often what we're doing is we're having students choose very early on, or maybe they don't even choose. And so, for instance, in the UK, I know of some programs where in the first year people, this is where there are teams, so it would work in the social sciences, it might not always work in humanities, where people visit, they have like 3 months where they're visiting with the research team and they get to see how it works, they see the students, they see the supervisor. And so they're beginning to get a sense of what's going on in the department, but also who they might find that they wanted to work with and that it would work well. So that at the end of the first year, that decision has to be made. And then other examples would be where supervisors come from outside the academy. For instance, again, social sciences, I don't know of humanities examples, but I could imagine them, within the UK where there are trusts. And so a student will choose to do some research connected to that trust, and someone from the trust, that's like an NGO, would be on the committee. And often, in fact, this is where funding comes in. There's a negotiation where the place that is also contributing something to the student's funding. So it has that come back as well. Another example, and this is again more a structural one, is where you see committees at the university level that are supporting doctoral students. that have sitting on them people from career services and from counseling and from libraries as well as academics. So they're all talking about the kinds of support they're trying to provide and thinking about how can they communicate that better. Does that kind of
That's answer? Great. Thank you. Thank you. We have time for another question.
Everybody wants their coffee and tea.
Thank you very much, Lynn and Susan. We will be back in 2 minutes. Go get your coffee.